Welcome to the first of a four-part series on King Records, Cincinnati Legacy. I'm Lee Hay. During this first show, you'll learn some of the history of King Records from music historians Darren Blaze and Randy McNutt. And you'll hear music from a number of King musicians, including Hank Ballard, the Dillmore Brothers, and Grandpa Jones. On the second and third programs of King Records, Cincinnati Legacy, there'll be a roundtable discussion moderated by music journalist Larry Nager, featuring Otis Williams and the Charms, session drummer Philip Paul along with his wife Juanita, and Keith Little, plus lots of music, interviews, and discussions of other King musicians. The fourth and final program will take a look at the continuing legacy of King Records and its influence on the recording industry since then. Let's begin with King Records, Cincinnati Legacy, Part 1.
My name is Darren Blaze. I own a little record shop here in Cincinnati called Shake It. My interest in King basically came from one day in a used record store, flipping through the bins, picking up a record by, I'm pretty sure it was a Hank Ballard record or something like that, and just catching my eye, flipping it over and seeing that it said Cincinnati, Ohio on it, and just bought it just to see what it was and put it on, and I was like, wow, this is really good. And it went from just being like, wow, something was actually made here in Cincinnati, to, wow, something was actually made in Cincinnati, and it's really good. So that was kind of my early introduction to it. And then working in record stores, slowly over time, meeting some of these guys that would come in and start talking, or, you know, you'd be playing an old Lonnie Johnson record or something that was recorded at King, and some old timer would mention it and start talking to you about it and say, oh, yeah, I used to work over there. I used to pack the boxes in the warehouse or doing whatever. And then meeting enough people to start to get a picture of it.
Tomorrow night, will you remember what you said tonight? Tomorrow night, will all the thrills be gone?
You know, the perfect example is talking to Bill Doggett one day about it, and he told me that on a Friday night he had recorded a session at King, and they had finished up around midnight, and everybody went home, and then that following Monday morning he had a show in Chicago. So they get to Chicago and they're blowing time and they go to a record store. And in that record store that Monday afternoon is the record that he recorded that previous Friday night. 3 days later, it's in the store. Which is why nobody really could have a hit on a King artist as a cover version. I mean, occasionally you would have Peggy Lee doing Fever and things like that. But nobody, well, it's not a hard and fast rule, but there are very, very few examples in a genre where cover versions and piggyback versions were the norm.
Thank you.
Cincinnati is just the most northern southern town, I guess is the best way to put it. And I've always kind of, people seem to think that that Ohio River makes a difference, and it doesn't. So this was the first stop for a lot of not only Appalachians, but blacks coming out of the South on their way to the industrial North. Some made it all the way to Detroit or Chicago. Some decided just to stop here too. So I think, you know, when you look at river towns, whether it's St. Louis or New Orleans, there's always these merging of different cultures that come together where lower working class people are put on the same levels and do the same jobs, whether they are working, loading and unloading boats or doing whatever. And I think that, to a degree, is the story of music in Cincinnati. King essentially just came upon and capitalized on it. The beginning of King is Sid Nathan owning a record store, or not really even a record store. It was a photo developing store and like a kind of a junk shop. A guy needing to settle a debt with him, giving him a couple hundred country or what were then called hillbilly records to settle the debt. And Sid takes them, puts them in a shop, and is blown away by how fast they sell. This guy's been a wrestling promoter and a boxing promoter and a film developer and all these, you know, he's just looking for the next angle. So he sees this as an opportunity. And as luck would have it, four blocks down the street are the WLW studios where they broadcast the Midwestern Hayride. So he starts seeing some of these guys come through. Grandpa Jones and the Delmore brothers, and he makes business contacts with these guys and begins to get some of the early country talent from the Midwestern Hayride to make some of those early King sides. A lot of the African American music comes in later when he starts buying some smaller labels and starts the Queen line, which then is the Queen as the R&B label and King is the country label, but eventually he kind of brings them all together. You know, there's just a set of studio musicians, and throughout the course of the day they do a jazz track and then a country track and then a jazz track and then an R&B track and then a jazz session and stuff like that. So some of those very early blues-oriented country crossovers with songs like Blues Stay Away From Me and just, for lack of a better term, white versions of songs like the Hucklebuck, they're so close that they're just slightly repackaged and then sold to a different audience. So, you know, a lot of those opportunities were brought to the surface by a gentleman named Henry Glover, who was kind of the first A&R man at King, and at that time probably the most powerful African-American in music, where he's leading a quickly growing independent record company and basically has full control over what he wants to do. Sid sees his ability to spot talent and a hit, so Henry's given a very, very, very long leash basically to do whatever he wants to do. And it's those people that are, I don't want to say Henry Glover's in the background, but he's not a name that turns up a lot when you talk of King, but these are the guys that are making it happen. And really, you have the charismatic, crazy cigar-chomping record label head played by Sid, and then you have the guys who are in the background, guys like Hal Neely and Henry Glover and Ralph Bass and Jim Wilson and all these guys who are doing the day-to-day operations and really figuring out how to keep this company growing and moving and everything.
My name is Randy McNutt. In 1970, I met a fellow named Wayne Perry, who was a singer in Hamilton, where I lived. We started a fledgling record production company featuring Wayne as the lead vocalist, and we recorded a track called Mr. Bus Driver. We didn't know what to do with it. we hoped to get it placed with King Records in Cincinnati because even though we were young and totally naive and uninformed, we did know that King was a big name in national and local music. So we decided to head in that direction. And Wayne knew a guy by the name of Bob, Mr. Movin' Patton. Gee, didn't everybody have a nickname at King Records, it seemed. Bob was a former disc jockey at WMOH in Hamilton, and Wayne had known him, and Wayne called him and said, hey, you know, we'd like to get somebody at King to listen to our track. And Bob said, hey, would you like to take a tour? So we went down, and by this time, it was early winter of 71, I guess, and we arrived at this place on this cold, bitterly cold night. I just remember how terrible it was because I had a Karmann Ghia with no heater in it, and we got down there and this building looked like something like you had taken a battleship and plucked it off the ocean and sat it down on Brewster Avenue, 1540 Brewster. The place just seemed all gray, dark, weathered brick. It was just very unappealing, and what I didn't know then was that a series of buildings all connected, I guess probably five of them. We went in and walked through this long, winding corridor. It just seemed like something from a funhouse. Everything was rather dark at night there, you know, and it was just the lights didn't light everything very well. So we walked down a hall, and I looked up, and the entire hallway was covered with album covers. There must have been 40 or 50 of these things all lined up on this wall. And I started looking at them and looking at the names, Cowboy Copas, Hawkshaw Hawkins, the Delmore Brothers, Bill Doggett, Earl Bostick, all these names that I really wasn't very familiar with as a kid of maybe, you know, 19 or so, 20 years old. I kept looking, and they were very garish and interesting covers, and we just kept walking. And finally, Bob said, now I want to show you the studio. So we got to the place, and I really wasn't that impressed. It just didn't really look too sophisticated to me. We had been recording over at Jewel Recording in Mount Healthy, owned by Rusty York. I remember Wayne going up to the microphone and joking around and said, I feel good. And, you know, right in this place, James Brown recorded and all the hit makers for King.
Please, 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 please.
Baby, take my hand. Baby, take my hand.
although there is sort of a mythology that's evolved about the studio, not every hit was cut in the King studio that King released. King did a lot of recording in L.A., New York, different cities. In fact, Brown would record out on the road. He recorded Papa's Got a Brand New Bag down in Charlotte, North Carolina at Arthur Smith's studio. But a lot of recording was done at King from about 1948 until the operation closed in Cincinnati in around 71. So that was my introduction to King, and we didn't get our record placed with King. Of course, King closed its Cincinnati operation, and that was about the end of that. For many years, King was the number one label in Cincinnati, the number one studio, and Sidney Nathan, the founder, was the number one record mogul. Sid was heavy, he had asthma, he had poor eyesight, his lenses were very thick. I remember one of the artists telling me that he described his glasses as Coke bottle, double lens glasses, whatever you want to call them. But Sid had quite a temper, but Sid was also a very, very talented record executive. He knew good material, and he is the guy who single-handedly forged this company back in the days at the end of World War II. With the help of some investors, got King going, and within 5 years or so, it was the number one independent in America. Right off the bat, Sid signed a lot of country artists who were working for WLW. He met the Delmore brothers. Alton Delmore walked into Sid's record shop on Central Avenue and described it as a dirty, filthy place, totally disorganized. There was no one around. He was looking for some spiritual records, that is, black gospel. And suddenly out pops this guy with an apron on, covered with multicolors from photo finishing in the back room. Sid did a little of this on the side because he once owned a photo finishing business. When Sid emerged, Alton Delmore described him as a, well, not to his face, of course, but later in his book, The Truth is Stranger Than Publicity, he described Sid as a a big groundhog emerging from his hole. But Sid must have been highly persuasive because he did persuade the Delmore brothers to join his new label, King Records, and also Cowboy Copas, who was another WLW performer.
Like a game, my darling. If you don't win, you always pout. Just like the game, the rules are the same. You can make three strikes and then you're out. That's all there is to the game, dear. If you cheat, the umpire throws you out. You cheated and you lied. You were never satisfied. You made three strikes and now you're out. Strike you made was when you cheated. The second strike was made when you walked out. The third strike was when you got your freedom. That makes three strikes and now you're out. That's all there is to the game, dear. If you cheat, the umpire throws you out. You cheated and you lied. You were never satisfied. You made three strikes and now you're out. Hear you shout that I was untrue or pitched a curve to you. You made three strikes and now you're out. That's all there is to the game, dear. If you cheat, the umpire throws you out. You cheated and you lied. You were never satisfied. You made three strikes and now you're out. Cheated and you lied, you were never satisfied. You made three strikes and now you're out.
And also Grandpa Jones, who was here in town at that time.
A smile I try to greet each early dawning, though they've given me a number for my name. Many little raindrops falling close to me will make the streams and rivers as muddy as can be. It's raining, raining, raining here this morning as the Mississippi flows on to the sea. I used to tell her every day I loved her, but now she doesn't love me anymore. She knew that I was guilty of that one crime and said that she'd be waiting there for me. But she has found somebody else to wonder why the Mississippi flows on to the sea. Just as weary as can me toward the silver sea. But there's no way to prove that I'm not guilty, so I will have to suffer all the shame. Go and tell her for me, little raindrop, that they've given me a number for my name.
So just so many things happening in Cincinnati. I think that's what people often ignore when they talk about the genesis of King Records. It could happen here because so many things came together at one time, sort of like the stars aligned just perfectly at that one time. Sid had had a series of business failures throughout his life, but all of a sudden he decided, hey, I want to start a record company. Very improbable, but yet he succeeded. And one of the reasons was that he had the talent pool right here. He didn't have to go anywhere else. He could just pluck them right off the roster of WLW, and he had the good musicians here to do studio work, the good singers. In those days, you could get play on the radio, even though you were an independent, and Sid managed to pull all these things together, but it wasn't easy. Sid had talent. He knew a good song. He knew talented singers, and he knew good musicians, and he knew what he wanted. And that was the most important thing. Sid knew what he wanted to hear. Now, sometimes this made him clash with the musicians, but I'd say Sid was right in the end because his records were hits.
All aboard for Nashville!
Good night, Cincinnati, and good morning, Tennessee. I'm heading into Nashville just as happy as can be. Hear the Mayfield drivers rolling, they're talking just to me. They say, good night, Cincinnati, good morning, Tennessee. I've been from Maine to Frisco, yes, I've traveled everywhere. I've rode the blinds and gone first class when I could pay my fare. There's not a train I haven't rode while I was on the roam. Now show me to that upper berth, 'cause I'm a-going home. Hey, good night, Cincinnati, and good morning, Tennessee. I'm heading into Nashville just as happy as can be. Hear the Mayfield drivers rolling, they're talking just to me. They say, good night, Cincinnati, good morning, Tennessee. Dixie Flyer, Super Chief in Santa Fe. The B&O and Chesapeake both took me on my way. Now I'm aboard the Hummingbird, she's humming, yes siree. It's good night, Cincinnati, good morning, Tennessee. Good night, Cincinnati, and good morning, Tennessee. I'm heading into Nashville just as happy as can be. Hear the Mayfield drivers rolling, they're talking just to me. They say, good night, Cincinnati, good morning, Tennessee. Cities, lots of people I have met, but there's one kind of special that I know I can't forget. She'll be waiting at the station with a great big kiss for me. It's good night, Cincinnati, good morning, Tennessee. Hey, good night, Cincinnati, and good morning, Tennessee. I'm heading into Nashville just as happy as can be. Hear the Mayfield drivers rolling, they're talking just to me. They say, good night, Cincinnati, good morning, Tennessee.
All out, Nashville!
After he got started, he realized that it was time, after about a year, to start a subsidiary label, which he had in the back of his mind all this time. And this would be for a black artist. It was called Queen Records. And about a year or so after he started in late 1943, he decided that Queen would be something that would further enhance sales. A lot of people believe that Queen was exclusively for R&B and blues, but, you know, at King, it was sort of loose, and you never knew what was going to pop up on what label. Suddenly, something totally unexpected would be released on Queen or any other label. But mainly, it was for the black artist. Now, in those days, it was tough getting airplay for what I would call genre music, roots music. Everything was geared towards pop. So Sid had his certain stations that he would promote his records to. And he started signing quite a few artists from Lucky Millinder's band. And Lucky Millinder had been a 1930s big band leader. He came into town to play at the Cotton Club, which was a segregated club in the West End, and about the only place in town that you could really see the races mingling in a club setting.
Friends are trying so hard to tempt me. There's no use trying, 'cause I'll be true. And darling, you don't have to worry. Nobody else will do.
Sid signed Lucky as an artist, and he signed Bull Moose Jackson, who had been a saxophone player with Lucky, and some other artists. And pretty soon Sid was charging through the R&B and blues field, just like he had the country field.
Start because the big fat legs are so far apart. I want a bow-legged woman right now. I want to find me a gal somehow. She's gotta be built like an old bass fiddle, big bow legs with plenty room in the middle. Gotta be on my way to find a bow-legged woman today.
He wants a bow-legged woman.
Boy, I'll fall in love with her right from the start, because the big fat legs are so far apart.
He wants a bow-legged woman.
Divine.
A bow-legged woman, that's fine.
She don't have to be no glamour gal, but cause you gotta have hoops like an old beer bear. Gotta be on my way to find a bow-legged woman today. She was really all right. She had a solid straddle when she came into battle. I jumped dead in the saddle. You couldn't hear a rattle, and there wasn't nobody there to run and tattle. Gotta be on my way to see my bow-legged woman today. I say, my woman with big bow legs.
By 1949, he had the sixth largest record company in the country and probably number one independent. So the subsidiary labels started to fall into place. Sid purchased the Deluxe label from the Braun Brothers, Linden, New Jersey, around 49 or 50. I'd have to look at my notes, but it was about that time. They were sort of a miniature version of King. They were doing a lot of R&B, particularly out of New Orleans. They had the New Orleans market pretty well in hand, and Sid hadn't cracked that. And they were coming up with some nice things down there by Roy Brown and Paul Gate and another artist. So Sid, by buying Deluxe Records, obtained all these masters and the artist. And so then he continued Deluxe as a subsidiary of King. So then he had that one going. He phased out Queen by this time.
Town to town. When I was
and he put a lot of those artists that are coming in that were black, he put them on Deluxe. Then he obtained another label, Bethlehem, a little later, and Bethlehem was mainly jazz. So Sid had several labels, and also he had a studio by this time, because in the late 40s he built one on the site against the recommendation of Howard Kessel, who was his number one investor, I guess you could call him. And Howard worked at the factory on Brewster Avenue and was head of the pressing facilities, Royal Plastics. One day, Howard went to Chicago on business, and when he returned, he found that Sid had ordered construction of the studio on property that the company didn't technically own. So they had to work out something with the owner, and finding a studio in those days wasn't quite as easy as it is today. There weren't really many studios in Cincinnati. Sid went over to E.T. Bucky Herzog's studio. He was a former engineer at WLW. Bucky once told me that he told Sid not to come anymore because Sid was getting worked up and getting upset about things in the session, and Bucky didn't want to deal with it. So Sid took his people out to L.A., and he took them to Chicago and New York. But if he had a studio here, he wouldn't have to spend all this money to fly or whatever he'd have to do to get to the different places. So he developed a studio. Some of the hits cut in the studio were Blues Stay Away From Me by the Delmore Brothers in 1949, Hangman's Boogie by Cowboy Copas in 49, I Wasted a Nickel by Hawkshaw Hawkins in 49, Mona Lisa by Moon Mullican, the king of the hillbilly piano players.
Mona Lisa, Mona Lisa, men have named you. You're so like the lady with the mystic smile. Is it only 'cause you're lonely they have blamed you? For that Mona Lisa strangeness in your smile. Do you smile to tempt a lover, Mona Lisa? Or is this your way to hide a broken heart? Many dreams have been brought to your doorstep. They just lie there and they die there. Are you warm? Are you real, Mona Lisa? Or just a cold and lonely, lovely work of art?
Slowpoke, Hawkshaw Hawkins, 1951. The Death of Hank Williams by Jack Cardwell in 1953. All these were country and country boogie things. Some of them were the forerunners of rockabilly music that would appear in the mid-50s. Jumping up in time a little bit, some of the hits done in the King studio were 17 by Boyd Bennett and his Rockets in 1955, which was a very early rockabilly record. became their only really big hit.
Solid 17, young enough to dance and sing, old enough to get that swing. Past 16, done been kissed, graduated and got that twist, the kind of love I can't resist. At 17, now sloppy shirt, old blue jean, dirty shoe, by all means, patch of blonde, peroxide hair, jukebox baby ain't no square. 17, hot rod queen, cutest gal you've ever seen. Hello world, I'm really keen on the hip cat doll of 17.
Daddy-O, another rockabilly hit by Bonnie Lou, the WLW star. Bonnie told me that she never felt comfortable doing rockabilly. She felt at home in the country field. The people at King crafted this song for her, wanted her to do it, and she felt that she should, and it just wasn't her thing, but it was a hit. Another hit cut there was All American Boy by Bill Parsons, who was really Bobby Bear, through a mix-up in the names on the tape boxes. That was for Fraternity Records. Fraternity was started circa 1954 by Harry Carlson, who was a Cincinnati portrait photography studio owner. And Harry was sort of the opposite of Sid. Harry was very laid back, very dignified, and Harry was very much into pop music. Started having hits with Ivory Tower by Kathy Carr. And he didn't have as many as Sid, but Fraternity was a very interesting label. Another hit cut in the studio was Memphis by Lonnie Mack for Fraternity. So you can see that Sid rented the studio to outside clients when he wasn't using it, so he was able to keep it busy. One of my favorites cut there was 1967, The Casinos, Then You Can Tell Me Goodbye, which the band played on, and just became a giant hit for them.
Kiss me each morning for a million years. Hold me each evening at your side. Tell me you'll love me for a million years. Then if it don't work, with a morning kiss, soften my dreams with your sigh. Tell me you love me for a million years. Then if it don't work out, then if it don't work, tell me goodbye.
Goodbye. just so that we can say we tried. Tell me you love me for a million years. Then if it don't work out, then if it don't work,
in the rhythm and blues field, some of the hits cut there included Good Rockin' Tonight by Wynonie Harris, a jump blues singer, and that was around 1948.
I heard the news, there's Good Rockin' Tonight. Away all my blues. Have you heard the news? There's good rockin' tonight. Everybody's gonna rock tonight. I'm gonna hold my baby tight as I can. Tonight she'll know I'm a mighty man. I got the news. Everybody's rocking tonight. Well, Elder Brown, Deacon Jones, they've even left the happy home. They'll be there just you wait to see. A jumping and a stomping at the Jubilee. Hey man, there's good rocking tonight. Sweet Lorraine, Sioux City Sue, sweet Georgia Brown, Caledonia too. They'll be there jumping like mad. Hey sister, ain't you glad? We got the news, there's good rocking tonight. Hoy, 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 there's good rockin' tonight. Hey, 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 everybody's rockin' tonight.
Some of the so-called risque records cut by King, Work With Me Annie and Annie Had a Baby, things like this by the Royals, who became the Midnighters.
So good, so good, so good, so good.
The original version of The Twist was cut in the studio, so it was quite an active place from 1948 until the early 70s.
This has been part one of a four-part series about King Records. Next week on part two of King Records, Cincinnati Legacy, you'll hear a roundtable discussion about Sid Nathan and King Records, moderated by Larry Nager with his guest Otis Williams and the Charms, King session drummer Philip Paul, and Keith Little. King Records Cincinnati Legacy was produced in the studios of WVXU in Cincinnati. Technical assistance from Darren Blaze and Shake It Records. I'm Lee Hay.